Recently, we agreed to give our youngest son an allowance. The problem is, we never actually had any cash, and so he would do his chores, and we just wouldn't have anything to give him. That's when we started to use Acorns Early. Acorns Early is the smart debit card and money app that grows kids' money skills as they grow up. You can start with the in-app chores tracker and teach your kids the value of a dollar. Then, you let your kids set their own savings goals and start building healthy money habits early. Kids even get their very own customizable debit card, giving them that extra sense of independence. Plus, with Acorn Early spending limits and real-time spend notifications, parents always stay in control. It's truly the easiest way to, one, give your kids an allowance, and two, teach them financial literacy without making it boring. Ready to teach your kids the smart way to earn, save, and spend? Get your first month on us when you head to acornsearly.com/ATTWG or download the Acorns Early app. That's 1 month free when you sign up at acornsearly.com/ATTWG.
Acorns Early Card is issued by Community Federal Savings Bank, member FDIC, pursuant to license by MasterCard International. Free trial for new subscribers only. Subscription fee starting from $5 per month unless canceled. Terms apply at acorns.com/early terms.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Darkcast Network. Welcome to the dark side of podcasting.
June 1st, 1997 was Kristen Modafferi's 18th birthday. On that day, she flew from her home in North Carolina to California to take a summer photography class at UC Berkeley. 23 days later, she disappeared. Police initially believed that she left on her own, but her family knew she would never do that. As the investigation unfolded, plenty of suspects popped up. The 4 male strangers she was renting a room from, a mysterious blonde woman she was seen talking to the afternoon she disappeared, the violent man who called a news station to say he knew exactly what had happened to her. But despite years of investigations by police and private investigators, the whereabouts of Kristen Modafferi, a brilliant, artistic young woman living her dream summer, remain unknown. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell you the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to tell you the story of Kristen Modafferi. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you for joining us once again. I'm Kona.
And I'm Ethan.
And we're the husband and wife team behind this podcast. Each week, I tell you the story of an unsolved missing persons case. Ethan doesn't know anything about the case going into the episode and is here to provide his reactions and questions in real time, hopefully asking some of the same ones you have at home. Today's story really got to me because Kristen seems like the type of person I would have looked up to. She was smart, independent, and adventurous. She fell in love with San Francisco during a family trip there in 1994 and decided to pack up and just move out there the summer after her freshman year at NC State. It was such a cool, brave thing to do, and it's heartbreaking that it ended so tragically for her. Before we get into Kristen's story, though, we'd like to thank our newest Patreon supporters. Taylor W., Hannah T., Kim Q., and Martha M. Thank you so much.
Thank you all so, so much.
If you want to join them, you can head over to our Patreon and join at any level, starting at just $2 a month for ad-free episodes and a free copy of the ebook that I wrote. Also, we started the Patreon about a year into doing the podcast, so our earliest episodes haven't been available there. However, thanks to a listener, I just found out that Patreon has a feature now that allows you to sync everything. So I'm working on getting the entire catalog uploaded.
Nice.
So yeah, so soon every single episode we've ever done will be available. Right now, I think it's missing like basically our entire first year. So if you are members and you see a bunch of uploads, like, sorry if that's annoying, but that's what it is.
Also, sorry because of the quality of recording that we were doing at the time.
Yeah, it was a rough, you know, a rough year, sound-wise, for sure, production-wise. But, you know.
You know, a tiny room in a townhouse with a baby in the room next to us sleeping.
Yeah, yeah. We tried. So with all of that out of the way, let's get into the story of Kristen Modafferi. Kristen Modafferi was born on June 1st, 1979 in Danbury, Connecticut, to Debbie and Bob Modafferi. She grew up as one of four girls. When she was about 10, her family moved south to Charlotte, North Carolina. Kristen was an exceptional student from the beginning, and after moving to North Carolina, she kept standing out. She skipped a grade in elementary school and found joy in art and photography. By high school, she was excelling academically and throwing herself into new challenges. Her hard work paid off in the form of the Park Scholarship, one of the most prestigious awards at North Carolina State University. It covered full tuition and was awarded to students who demonstrated exceptional scholarship, leadership, and service. She planned to study political science and art, blending her analytical skills with her creative side. Kristen wasn't afraid to push herself out of her comfort zone. In the summer after her freshman year at NC State, she made a bold choice. Instead of going home, she would spend the summer in California. She wanted to take a summer photography course at UC Berkeley and immerse herself in a new city. The plan was adventurous, but practical. It would allow her to build her portfolio, earn some college credits, and experience life on the West Coast. Her parents, of course, weren't quite on board at first because she was so young.
Yeah, I mean, doing that when you're 18.
But that's the thing. Like, she was a year behind everyone because she skipped a grade. So, like, she did her freshman year when she was 17. And she finished her freshman year when she was still 17. So she was, like, younger than her peers, even, you know?
Yeah, I mean, look, I did a Midwest road trip when I turned 18. I didn't even make it across country.
Yeah.
And I thought that that was crazy and courageous. But yeah, going out to the West Coast, you know, on your own at that age just seems wild to me.
Right. Because you did your road trip with a friend. Like, yeah, she was just completely on her own. You'll die. Like, even when you learn what else she did. Because she was a planner and was incredibly resourceful, especially considering that this was 1997 when the internet was really still in its early days. Kristen used one of the early iterations of Craigslist to find a room for rent in Oakland. She arranged to live in a house on Jane Avenue with four male roommates whom she had never met in person.
Oh, they were still, they were living there. So when you said that, In the intro, like, I thought that they were, like, leasing out their apartment or for, you know, subletting it as they went away to back home for the summer or something.
No. So what had happened, actually, was I guess there were five bedrooms in the house, and one of the guys had a girlfriend, and she was in the other bedroom, and the two of them had decided to take a break. So she left and her room was open. And so Kristen ended up renting her room. She also secured two jobs to support herself during her stay. A weekday job as a barista at Spinelli's Coffee in downtown San Francisco's Crocker Galleria Mall, and a weekend gig at Cafe Museo in the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. On top of working, she enrolled in the photography class at UC Berkeley that would start later in June. So she was so together. Yeah, a busy summer, but like she really planned everything out. She had her plan and she was taking care of it, you know? So with her parents' blessing, on June 1st, 1997, her 18th birthday, Kristen boarded a plane bound for San Francisco. She was stepping into what should have been an unforgettable summer, but she never made it back home. Once she arrived in the Bay Area, everything seemed to be going according to plan. In phone calls home and letters she mailed, Kristen captured snapshots of her life. She marveled at how the fog draped over the Golden Gate Bridge and chatted about her new jobs. At Spinelli's, she quickly became known among her coworkers as friendly, reliable, and a fast learner. By the middle of June, Kristen had built a comfortable routine. She commuted into the city for work, prepared for her photography class, and spent her free time exploring her new home. Everything seemed to be unfolding exactly the way she had hoped. Kristen began Monday, June 23rd, 1997, just as she had every morning that summer, riding the BART train from Oakland into the heart of San Francisco before sunrise, ready for her shift at Spinelli's. That morning, she clocked in and worked her normal shift from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. That day, Kristen reportedly asked a coworker for directions to Land's End, a coastal area offering dramatic views near Sutro Baths. She'd photographed the area before, and some accounts suggest that she intended to return there that afternoon. But she didn't give a firm commitment. It may have been her plan, but it could have just been an offhand comment or an idea that she had. So basically, from one of the accounts that I read, like, she had just been talking to some coworkers that day and was like, hey, what should I do? Where should I go? You know, asking for suggestions. And they suggested a bunch of things. This was one of them. She had done a lot of them already. So it was like, yeah, maybe I'll go back to Land's End, take some pictures. But it really wasn't set in stone or anything like that. Also, when I was researching this, I was very confused at the beginning when it said that she was heading to Land's End and that she might have disappeared from there because she worked in a mall and I very much thought that they meant the store because I did not think, I did not know that Land's End was a place.
I mean, honestly, I had forgotten about the store, so.
I just thought they're like, oh, yeah, she's going to go to Land's End after work and buy like a pullover and then was never seen again. But no, like apparently that exists. At some point around 3:45 p.m., a coworker thinks that they saw Kristen on the second floor of the Crocker Galleria talking with a blonde woman who was unfamiliar to them. And this woman looked to be in her late 20s. And it struck the coworker as odd because Kristen usually left the mall immediately after clocking out. Over the years, police have asked the woman to come forward. You know, they made public appeals, they've gone on the news, but no one ever has. So while she was likely seen around 3:45 that day after she left work, the sighting can't be 100% confirmed. Like, yes, the coworker, you know, did know her, but again, it was the second floor. They're kind of far away. There is a possibility that it wasn't her, though it does seem pretty solid in, as far as the sighting goes. What we do know is that she never showed up for her photography class at UC Berkeley the next day, June 24th. And that's the thing. June 24th was the first day of this class.
Oh, wow.
So the timing is crazy. She also had a $400 paycheck at Spinelli's that she left behind. You know, I don't know if it was ready when she left that day at three or if it was ready, you know, the next day or whatever,
right.
But she never got it. And according to her roommates, she didn't return home that evening. Now, Kristen not coming home didn't raise a red flag to them. Remember, they didn't know her.
Right. And you also said that she, in her free time, would like to go out and explore the city.
Yeah,
so
yeah, it doesn't sound like she necessarily spent a ton of time at home. She had two jobs. And yeah, she was always out like taking photos and exploring.
And it was probably weird living with four male roommates that she doesn't know.
Exactly. So when she didn't come home, they just assumed that she had like other friends or a boyfriend or whatever. And she was just staying with them.
Yeah.
It wasn't until June 26th when her father left a message on the house landline that alarm bells started to go off. One of her roommates called him back and told him that they hadn't seen Kristen for 3 days. This is a paid advertisement from BetterHelp. We've all done it before. We've turned to our barista or hairdresser or, you know, a random stranger in the bathroom and asked for life advice. And while all of that does have its place, when you're looking for help about relationships, anxiety, or other clinical issues, they might not have all the right answers. Instead, why not try talking to a credentialed therapist online with BetterHelp? BetterHelp has been helping people find their match for over 10 years. and their therapists work according to a strict code of conduct and are fully licensed in the U.S. BetterHelp does the initial matching work for you so you can focus on your therapy goals. All you have to do is fill out a short questionnaire to identify your needs and preferences, and their 10 plus years of experience and industry-leading match fulfillment rate means that they will typically get it right the first time. But if you aren't happy with your match, you can switch to a different therapist at any time. Plus, this is so convenient. It's completely online, so you can use your subscription whenever you need to. As the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a diverse variety of expertise. And as a special offer, our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/ATTWG. That's betterhelp.com/ATTWG. Find the one with BetterHelp. Are you planning a trip abroad this year? Imagine how much better your travel experience could be if you could speak the language. With Rosetta Stone, you'll gain the confidence to have real conversations and create deeper connections wherever you go. Rosetta Stone is the trusted leader in language learning for over 30 years. Their immersive, intuitive method helps you naturally absorb and retain your new language on desktop or mobile, whenever and wherever it fits your schedule. One of my favorite places to visit is Spain, and as it turns out, my 3 years of high school Spanish does not quite cut it over there. And that's what's great about Rosetta Stone. You can learn faster and retain longer. They immerse you in your new language naturally, which helps you think and communicate with confidence. There are no English translations, so you truly learn to speak, listen, and think in your chosen language. So don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. And Then They Were Gone listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. Her family knew that Kristen wouldn't just blow off her class. It was the whole reason she had come to California in the first place. They also knew that she wasn't just staying at a friend's house.
Because she didn't know anybody.
Yeah, apparently, I did read like one thing that said that she actually did know somebody who was taking that same photography class.
Okay.
And that kind of helped sound the alarm because she also thought it was weird that Kristen didn't show up. But I don't know how close they were or even how they knew each other.
But, or where she was living or right. anything.
And, yeah, but basically, yeah, she really didn't know anyone, you know? So her family immediately knew that something was horribly wrong. As soon as they found out that she was missing, they flew to San Francisco and filed a missing persons report with Oakland police. Unfortunately, because she was an adult, remember, she had just turned 18 3 weeks earlier.
Yeah.
The investigation didn't start immediately. June 27th, when they arrived, was a Friday, and detectives didn't start working on her case until the following Monday, June 30th.
Were they off, or did they just not think it was a priority because she was 18?
I think both. I mean, you got to think, like, you're a cop, and, you know, once you get to a certain level, you generally get weekends off, unless something crazy happens.
Well, yeah, but this is a larger police force. I'm sure there are detectives that work weekends.
Right. But so whenever the detective got to work on Monday, he said that hers was one of 25 missing persons reports on his desk.
Jesus.
Yeah. So, yeah, it just wasn't considered a priority when it was first reported.
And I hope this doesn't turn into a situation where Oakland PD says, well, there's no evidence that she went missing in Oakland. She was last seen in San Francisco.
Yeah, no, that actually doesn't come into play, which is kind of surprising.
That is surprising, yeah.
Yeah, because she was last seen in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Even though she lived in Oakland. And for those of you who are unfamiliar, Oakland and San Francisco are very close to each other.
Yeah.
But
it's still
two different police
different
forces.
Jurisdictions, right?
Yeah. So that could very easily have been like, I don't know, it doesn't seem like my problem. But it doesn't seem as though that happened.
I mean, that's good.
Yeah. Even though the police weren't going to start investigating till Monday, you know, her family got there on Friday. They obviously weren't going to just wait around and do nothing for the entire weekend. So they took matters into their own hands. From the moment that they landed in California, the Modafferis began organizing their own search efforts. Bob and Debbie immediately hired a private investigator to supplement the police's work. Within hours, that PI hit the ground running and spoke with Kristen's roommates, co-workers, and friends. In fact, he managed to conduct initial interviews before detectives even could. Detective Pat Mahaney of OPD, who received Kristen's case among dozens of others on his desk, noticed the family's proactive approach. He later told reporters, quote, "It was one of 25 reports I got that morning. Then I heard the PI's involvement, so we put it in the priority pile," end quote. In other words, the family's quick action spurred police to take Kristen's disappearance more seriously in those early days, which is honestly really disheartening.
Yeah, I mean, when you're saying that, the first thought that I had was that, okay, this is a priority because the family can afford a private investigator.
Exactly.
Like, that was immediately what my thought was. And like, I mean, that's like a gut punch to me.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, I'm happy for Kristen.
Yes. No, absolutely.
Her family had those resources.
But what about the other 24 cases?
Exactly. Exactly. And yes, the majority of them were gone, you know, because they wanted to be gone, right? It's not like they had 25 people who were kidnapped or 25 people who were murdered or, you know, like,
sure.
It wasn't like that. That's not how missing persons cases work. But of that 25, maybe one more was, you know, and maybe that one didn't get the attention because that family didn't have the money, didn't have the wherewithal, the presence of mind, the ability to hire outside help to make the police take it seriously. And you're right. It is an absolute gut punch. And it's basically, you know, what we've been yammering on about for the past 5 years of doing this show. It's just absolutely heartbreaking because every missing person deserves to have their case taken seriously, even if their family doesn't have money for a PI. Meanwhile, Bob, Debbie, and their three other daughters walked the city streets handing out flyers with Kristen's face and description. They plastered missing persons posters on building walls, telephone poles, bus stops, anywhere that might catch a passerby's eye. Kristen's youngest sister, Megan, helped hand out flyers too. She was only 7 at the time. She later told reporters, quote, "I expected we would find her. I expected it was just going up to enough people with the flyers on the street and then someone would say, yes, of course, I've seen her," end quote. From the start, the Modafferis also sought help from the media. Within the first week of Kristen's disappearance, local news stations picked up the story of the missing college student. The Modafferis gave interviews and pleaded for the public's assistance in finding their daughter. Charlotte's WSOC-TV even sent a crew to California multiple times to follow the search and cover any developments. To encourage tips, the family and authorities quickly announced a $50,000 reward for information leading to Kristen's safe return. Once the Oakland police began actively working the case in late June, they coordinated with the Modafferis' private investigator and started digging into Kristen's last known activities. They interviewed everyone in her orbit and compared notes with the private eye. All of Kristen's new friends and colleagues told consistent stories. No one saw her after that possible 3:45 sighting on June 23rd, and nobody recalled her expressing plans to meet anyone specific that afternoon beyond that just casual idea of going to the beach. The housemates in Oakland were cooperative and quickly cleared of any suspicion. In the early investigation, there were no obvious suspects and no clear motive, just an 18-year-old who had disappeared into thin air. However, a few puzzling clues did surface. While searching Kristen's room in Oakland, investigators discovered a copy of the San Francisco Bay Guardian newspaper from the week before she went missing. Inside, a personal advertisement had been neatly circled in pen. The ad read, quote, "Friends. Female seeking friends to share activities who enjoy music, photography, working out, walks, coffee, or simply the beach, exploring the Bay Area. Interested? Call me," end quote. Those interests were strikingly similar to Kristen's own. Photography, coffee, the beach. And it raised questions. Had Kristen herself placed this ad in hopes of making new friends, or had she spotted it and planned to respond? Could the female seeking friends have been the blonde from the mall? Investigators tried to chase down the lead, but it fizzled out. The newspaper's offices had already purged records of who submitted the ad, and there was no way to trace the anonymous person behind it. To this day, it remains unclear whether the circled ad was connected to Kristen's disappearance or just a coincidence.
So how were people supposed to get in touch with this person? It says call, right?
Right, but they didn't give like their number. There was a number that you would call that, like, so the way personal ads usually worked back then was you would call a number that was run by the newspaper, and they would have like a voicemail box or something along those lines.
Okay.
And you would call that. But it would only be active for the amount of time you were running the ad.
Gotcha.
So if you tried to call or do whatever, you know, weeks later, it wouldn't go anywhere.
And I'm assuming she didn't have a cell phone.
Not that I've ever heard, no. And again, it was 1997. Cell phones certainly existed, but not
they
a lot of people
very,
had
they weren't
them.
Prevalent, right.
Yeah. Another early effort by law enforcement was more old-fashioned. They brought in a bloodhound to track Kristen's scent. Using clothing and personal items from Kristen's room as a scent source, handlers led the dog to the Crocker Galleria where Kristen was last seen. The bloodhound picked up her trail and proceeded to follow it out of the mall and onto the city streets. The dog went west along Geary Street as if tracing the route toward the ocean. And this made sense to detectives, since one theory was that Kristen might have taken the Muni bus out to Land's End or Baker Beach that afternoon. In fact, the bloodhound did alert along the path of the 38 Geary bus line, the line that runs from downtown toward Land's End. The dog ultimately tracked the scent to Sutro Heights Park near Land's End and the Pacific Coast, but then the trail grew faint. After roughly 20 minutes, the bloodhound could follow no further. This suggested that Kristen may indeed have made it out to the Seaside Park or somewhere nearby on June 23rd. Unfortunately, it provided no definitive proof of what happened next. A search of beaches and trails in that area turned up no sign of Kristen. Whether she actually went there on her own, met someone en route, or never even left downtown remains unknown. As days turned into weeks with no sign of Kristen, the situation grew more desperate. The Modafferis and investigators were chasing every lead, no matter how slim. Then, on July 10th, 1997, a little over 2 weeks after Kristen disappeared, a startling tip came in that briefly raised hopes. An assignment editor at KGO-TV, San Francisco's ABC affiliate, received a bizarre phone call from an anonymous man. The caller claimed that he knew exactly what had happened to Kristen. In a detailed story, he said that two women he said were lesbians had abducted and murdered Kristen in a fit of jealousy. Then they drove her north and dumped her body by a wooden bridge on the way to Point Reyes, which is a rural coastal area north of San Francisco. The allegations were extremely specific and disturbing. KGO alerted the police, and Detective Mahaney followed up immediately on this wild story. The unnamed caller had provided names. He identified two local women as the supposed killers and said that they worked at a YMCA in San Francisco. Investigators found these two women and questioned them. Very quickly, it became clear that they had nothing to do with Kristen's disappearance.
Yeah.
Both women were bewildered by the accusation and had never met Kristen. Mahaney later said that he found them, quote, unlikely suspects, to say the least, end quote, and they were soon cleared of any involvement.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many holes with what that guy reported, like a fit of jealousy. Why? Why would they be jealous of this newly
random
turned 18-year-old girl,
yeah,
right? Like, and to name them specifically, to me, it sounds like whoever the caller was had some sort of issue with them. More than likely, their sexuality. That would be my guess.
Well, I don't even know if they were lesbians. I think he might have just said that.
He just made that up too.
Yeah. I mean, maybe they were, maybe they weren't. But you are correct in that, yes, he did have a particular problem with them.
Yeah.
Once investigators talked to the ladies, and they obviously had nothing to do with anything, they're like, okay, well, this is clearly a prank, but like, why?
Yeah, and why specifically about them?
Right, and who would do this? Police managed to trace the phone tip, and the caller was identified as John Onuma, a 36-year-old man who lived near the Crocker Galleria in San Francisco, uncomfortably close to where Kristen was last seen. Onuma was brought in for questioning, and while he initially denied making the call, his story quickly fell apart. He eventually admitted that he did call, but everything he told KGO was false. During questioning, Onuma revealed his absurd motive. He told police that he made the call to get back at those two women because he believed that they were trying to get his girlfriend fired from her job at the YMCA.
What?
Onuma also denied ever having met Kristen. And at the time, the investigators found no link between the two.
Other than the proximity?
Yeah, exactly. But no, like there's no indication that he did know her, he had ever met her, anything. A search of Onuma's apartment did turn up some bloodstains that alarmed detectives, but forensic testing showed that the blood was from a cat and wasn't human. While the FBI later cleared him as a suspect in Kristen's case, OPD hasn't. And we'll get more into that later. Though this tip may have just been an ill-advised prank, it generated significant media attention during that summer. The lurid tale of jealous women and a body by a bridge made headlines. The incident was considered notable enough that it was later highlighted in a 1999 segment of America's Most Wanted about Kristen's disappearance. But once the tip was debunked, the investigation was essentially back to square one. No other solid leads materialized in those early weeks. By the end of the summer of 1997, the Modafferi family had exhausted every avenue they could think of in the Bay Area, but they refused to let Kristen's case fade from view. In the months immediately following her disappearance, the family put up billboards around San Francisco displaying Kristen's smiling high school graduation photo alongside the words, "Forever in our hearts." They went back home, but returned to California repeatedly to meet with investigators, canvass neighborhoods, and keep the search alive. Law enforcement, for its part, pursued tips as they arose and executed up to 17 search warrants on various locations related to possible leads. Yet, no arrest was ever made, and no physical evidence of Kristen's fate was found in those initial stages. Despite the extensive collaboration between the family, local police, private investigators, and even federal agents, the early investigation yielded more questions than answers. I work from home, so it drives me crazy when my house is a mess, but I don't really have the time or the mental energy to keep it looking as clean as I want. That's why I'm so glad that HomeAglow exists. They're a top-rated home service platform that's dedicated to making your space clean and tidy. And what I love is their flexibility and how easy it is to use. They have online booking capabilities that allow you to instantly schedule a cleaner in your area for a special occasion, party, or for regular cleanings. Cleaners pass a rigorous certification process and maintain a 4.8-star average platform rating. It's a fantastic way to support cleaners in your community, and 100% of cleaning fees and tips go directly to your cleaner. To schedule a cleaning, you simply go to HomeAglow's website to choose the day and time you're looking for and the duration of your cleaning to match with the cleaner. The best part is their Forever Clean membership, which saves you $30 an hour on all future cleanings. You can book unlimited cleanings starting at $19 an hour back by HomeAglow's happiness guarantee. Take home cleaning off your plate this fall by using HomeAglow. Head to homeaglow.com/ATTWG to get your first 3 hours of cleaning for only $19. That's HomeAglow.com/ATTWG. Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's revolutionizing how we deal with life's challenges, from sleepless nights to stress-filled days. Mood.com has created an entire line of functional gummies that target specific health concerns with 100% federally legal THC blends, and they'll deliver them discreetly right to your doorstep. Even better, you can get 20% off your first order at mood.com with promo code ATTWG. We've been advertising Mood for a while. They've been really good to us. And after trying some of their gummies, it is wild how different each one feels. Those sleepy time gummies will knock you out in about 15 minutes flat. No hangovers, no grogginess. What makes these different is how they've paired THC and other cannabinoids with herbs and adaptogens. You're not going to find gummies like this in a dispensary or anywhere for that matter. They've got immune support, menopause relief, PMS, mental clarity, sexual arousal, and all of them use federally legal cannabis, and it's all grown on small family-owned American farms, and they can ship to most states in the U.S. And best of all, not only does Mood stand behind everything with an industry-leading 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code ATTWG. So head to mood.com and remember, use promo code ATTWG at checkout to save 20% on your first order. Ever noticed how many unnecessary chemicals are in your cleaning products? When I started looking into what I was actually using around my home, I realized that my laundry detergent might just be the worst offender. So many popular brands are packed with harsh chemicals that can irritate your skin, mess up your hormones, and cause allergic reactions. So instead of continuing to use those dye-filled pods, I switched to Earth Breeze. Their detergent actually comes in sheets that are free from harsh chemicals like optical brighteners, dyes, parabens, phosphates, and preservatives. It also doesn't come in those plastic jugs. It's just a lightweight, pre-measured sheet that dissolves in the wash and gets the job done. And yes, your clothes still come out clean, fresh, and soft. I feel so much better knowing that I'm not exposing myself and my family to those unnecessary toxins. So if you're looking for a powerful clean without the harsh chemicals, try Earth Breeze. It's easy to switch, and if you're not completely satisfied, they have an amazing money-back guarantee. And right now, you can try Earth Breeze for up to 40% off plus 4 free gifts at earthbreeze.com/ATTWG. That's earthbreeze.com/ATTWG for 40% off plus 4 free gifts. Did you know that a single finger prick at home can give you over 180 personalized insights into how to improve your health and slow your aging? If you've been listening to this show for a while, you know that I tried the True Age and True Health test by True Diagnostic, and it showed me things I never learned from my regular physicals. True Health looks at over 105 biomarkers tied to your nutritional, metabolic, immune, and cognitive health. You'll see your vitamin levels, your nutrient balance, inflammation, gut health, and more. True Age measures 75 plus biomarkers to reveal your biological age, your pace of aging, and the age of key organ systems. It doesn't just give you a single number, it shows how your heart, brain, liver, and immune system are all aging. Together, the combo gives you a complete picture of your health today, along with personalized recommendations to improve your health and slow down aging. For me, it really inspired me to work on my cardiovascular health. It's so hard to get answers at the doctor's office, so I loved getting this report that had so much information on it. If you're serious about living healthier and longer, visit truediagnostic.com and use my code ATTWG for 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com, code ATTWG for 20% off. Your future self will thank you. One major question that lingered was, did Kristen make it home at all on June 23rd? Her roommate says she didn't. And for years after Kristen's disappearance, the house, located at 274 Jane Avenue in Oakland, was just a footnote. But in recent years, this home has become the focus of dramatic new investigative efforts. These efforts, involving cadaver dogs, advanced forensic tests, and police digs, have breathed new life into the case. In June 2015, on the 18th anniversary of Kristen's disappearance, Paul Dosti, a retired police sergeant turned forensic investigator, arrived at 274 Jane Avenue with his cadaver dog, Buster. Buster was no ordinary dog. The three-legged black Labrador had a world-class reputation for uncovering remains of missing soldiers and crime victims. With the new homeowner's permission, Dosti led Buster around the property in hopes of finding any trace of Kristen. Each time the dog sniffed near vent openings to the basement, he let out a loud bark, signaling the scent of human decomposition. Buster even followed a chemical plume scent trail downhill from the backyard toward a drainage pipe on a lower street, as if whatever he smelled in the basement had traveled through the soil. Dosti told a reporter on the scene, quote, "There's human decomposition in here. Someone's dead here," end quote. It was a stunning development. After nearly two decades, an indication that human remains, perhaps Kristen's, could be present at her former home. In the musty basement, Dosti noticed something else. A section of concrete flooring that looked like a, quote, "hack job" on the dirt floor. He later urged authorities to excavate that poorly finished slab and test the soil beneath. Given Buster's strong alerts, Dosti also recommended that Oakland police take a hard look at Kristen's old roommates and re-interview them, wondering if something tragic had happened in that basement back in 1997. Oakland police did take this 2015 lead seriously, at least initially. Acting on Dosti's tip, investigators consulted a forensic team from Chico State University to scan the basement with ground-penetrating radar. The GPR identified an area of interest beneath the slab. It was an anomaly that warranted a closer look. Investigators soon returned to dig into the basement floor in that spot. It was the first official search at Kristen's residence in years. But as shovels hit the ground, the promise of a breakthrough faded. The soil under the house turned out to be dense, hard-packed clay and was almost impenetrable. There was no body buried there. Though the initial dig found nothing, Paul Dosti was not ready to give up on Jane Avenue. He returned to the property in February 2017, this time alongside Dr. Arpad Vaas, a renowned forensic anthropologist from the Oak Ridge National Laboratory. Dr. Vaas brought with him a cutting-edge decomposition chemical detector, a proprietary device he developed to identify chemical traces left by human decomposition. If Dr. Vaas's name sounds familiar to any of you, it's because we've talked about him and his device on this podcast before. In our episode on Tammy Akers and Angela Rader, which I believe was back in 2021, we talked about how Dr. Vaas brought his machine in to help investigate the case of a murdered college student right here in Virginia, Gina Hall. During this investigation, he not only found evidence of Gina's remains, but also of Angela Rader's. Now, in this case, Vaas's device pinpointed an area between 274 Jane Avenue and the adjacent house, 278 Jane Avenue. Specifically, the signal focused at the base of an outdoor concrete stairway on the neighboring property. This was just feet away from Kristen's old basement. When Vaas and Dosti tested soil and material from that spot, they detected the unmistakable signature of human blood or decomposed tissue. What's crazier was what came next. According to the private investigators, the DNA profile of the decomposition material was consistent with Kristen's lineage. Kristen's parents had given DNA samples, and according to them, it matched the family. To Dosti and Vaas, the finding was tantamount to a smoking gun. They believed that they had uncovered Kristen's blood in the soil, right there between the two houses. Importantly, they noted that this did not look like a grave site. Instead of an entire body buried, the evidence pointed to it being a crime scene. Perhaps something violent happened at the house, an assault or a murder, and the victim's blood seeped into the ground near the porch steps. While this discovery may point to the roommates Kristen had found on Craigslist, another thing that was discovered around this time, which was not known back in 1997, was that that house next door, 278, was a halfway house for probation violators from the Oakland and Alameda County region, which opened up an entirely new pool of suspects.
Wow. Yeah. That's crazy. How was that not known back in 1997?
I have no idea.
Oakland PD missed that?
I have no idea. But it was not known. And it wasn't until like years later, and again, around this time, or I think it was before this, but like at some point the HOA sent out a letter. It was like, hey, there's this halfway house here and they're causing problems. We don't like it, whatever. And they found out that, yeah, it was just a bunch of probation violators living right next door.
And nobody knew it.
Nobody knew.
Wow.
But by this time, you know, when they were doing the testing, the house had been sold and it was now privately owned.
Sure.
And everybody who had been living there in 1997 was long gone.
And probably most of the records of the people that lived there, if not all of them.
Exactly. For Kristen's family, these developments in 2017 brought a mix of heartbreak and hope. Kristen's sister, Megan, expressed optimism, saying, quote, "This new DNA evidence, to me, it changes everything. It's like starting over. It's like a whole new story," end quote. For the first time in ages, there was a concrete lead suggesting what might have happened to Kristen. But as exciting as Voss and Dosti's findings were, they also raised questions. This lead came from a novel forensic technique that had not yet been proven in court. Dr. Voss's detector was proprietary and its exact workings were a closely guarded secret. OPD could not simply accept the private investigator's word. Any evidence would need to be verified through traditional admissible methods before it could advance the case. And for a while, there was public friction between the independent investigators and OPD. In mid-2018, Oakland police stated that they had not yet been able to move forward with testing at the Jane Avenue site. A police spokesperson, Felicia Aisthorpe, said the department was waiting on additional information from Dr. Voss on how to collect and analyze samples using his method. Furthermore, she claimed that details of the alleged blood evidence on the neighbor's porch had not been formally shared with OPD. Dosti and Voss strongly disagreed with that characterization. They insisted that they had given police plenty to go on. Dr. Voss even outlined how OPD could verify the findings themselves. They could bring cadaver dogs to the location to see if they alert, or simply collect soil samples and run them through a gas chromatograph mass spectrometer analysis to detect human-specific volatile compounds. To Voss and Dosti, the science was sound. The police just needed to act on it.
Obviously, there's issues with the testing and all of that. That still opens a potential doorway for investigators to revisit the roommates, at least.
Yeah.
And maybe do some digging and try and find out who was living at the halfway house at the time. I mean, that's like, you don't need forensic tests to do that.
Right. And I don't know what, if any, digging they did into the halfway house. I'm not entirely sure if they re-interviewed the roommates. I know that the private investigator did. So there was a private investigator, Dennis Mann, who...
And this is in 2015.
2017, 2018 by this point. Yeah. I do know that the Dennis Mann did end up re-interviewing all of the roommates, I think several times. And he actually said that he's pretty confident that they actually didn't have anything to do with anything and that they were always very cordial and very cooperative toward him to a point. He was just like, at some point, they were like, hey, we've gone over everything. Like, if new stuff pops up, you can talk to us, but like, we don't really want to talk about this anymore, which, you know, is fair.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah, but I don't know what OPD did in that regard. And nothing I've read said that OPD ever brought in cadaver dogs or GPR or anything like that. The only thing that I've ever seen is that being done privately. And to me, that does seem like a missed opportunity, especially considering that the owners were seemingly fine with all of this investigation going on at their house, which is usually a barrier when it comes to cases like this.
Yeah.
So by late 2018, the momentum that had started from all of this had stalled. Despite the Modafferi family's urging and the investigators' confidence, no further excavation or testing had been publicly reported at the Jane Avenue house. So what are we to make of the Jane Avenue house evidence today? Opinions diverge between those who believe the house may have been Kristen's final stop and those who doubt that she ever returned there on June 23rd. Crucially, Mahaney, one of the original detectives of Kristen's case, quote, strongly believes Kristen never made it back to Oakland that day, end quote. If true, that would mean that the entire saga at that house, the barking dog, the curious chemicals in the soil, it might all be a red herring. Mahaney and the other investigators instead lean toward a theory that Kristen met with foul play in San Francisco, where she was last seen, or perhaps that she was abducted and disposed of elsewhere.
Well, we also have the bloodhound that traced her scent out to Land's End.
Exactly. Yeah. So she's going out there. I mean, she obviously could have done that and then gone to Oakland later.
Sure.
But not necessarily. In fact, Mahaney suspects that Kristen's body may have been, quote, dumped off a bridge in Marin County, end quote, referring to the alleged hoax that John Onuma phoned in back in 1997. Yeah, I mean,
why would he say that, given that we know that that wasn't a real, I mean, it was a real phone call, but given that it wasn't real?
Because he and a lot of other people believe that while those two poor ladies at the YMCA didn't have anything to do with anything, that maybe there was some truth to the call. And maybe John Onuna was the one who was behind it. On the website findkristen.com, investigator Dennis Mann, who had been assisting on Kristen's case since the early days, has written out a pretty compelling theory related to John Onuma and his girlfriend at the time, Jill Lampo. It turns out there actually is a connection between John, Jill, and Kristen. In May 1998, right before the one-year anniversary of Kristen's disappearance, police searched Jill Lampo's apartment. In it, they found a day planner with several pages ripped out. These pages corresponded to dates surrounding Kristen's disappearance the year before. One thing they did find in the planner was the name Matthew Luque. Matthew and Jill used to date, but she broke up with him to date John Onuna. Matthew began working at Spinelli's Coffee shortly after Kristen's disappearance, so though he worked at the same place, he never met her. However, he was referred there by a friend, Kelly Strathman, who did know and work with Kristen while she was at Spinelli's. Now, this is obviously a pretty tenuous connection.
Yeah, I was going to say that I don't actually see the direct connection between...
It's like, there are like 3 degrees of separation, yeah. But it's there, you know. There are a few other factors that made me want to mention it. When the America's Most Wanted segment on Kristen's case came out, several women spoke about their experiences with Onuna. He apparently had a history of finding women via personal ads and then scammed them out of money and abused them. One woman who wanted to remain anonymous met Onuna several months after Kristen's disappearance. And here's what she had to say directly from that episode.
He hit me over the head with ropes and said, quote unquote, you know, I'm going to have to kill you. I can't let you go. And then he turned around and says, now you know what happened to Kristen Modafferi. I backed myself up in the corner because I thought he was going to kill me. I thought... he killed her. So, and I never knew nothing about Kristen. And then the police showed up to talk to John and they brought up Kristen, which scared me.
When did this happen? This was a year after
No, when she met him, it was several months after Kristen's disappearance. I don't know exactly when.
Okay. I don't understand the scam aspect of it, and it's neither here nor there.
I didn't play it for you, but there were two or three other women who spoke on the episode of America's Most Wanted who talked about how he would find them in these personal ads. He'd draw them in. Then he would steal money from them. He would abuse them. One lady said that she was basically a sex slave. He would burn her with cigarettes.
Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, that's pretty compelling evidence right there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this guy seems like there was more going on than just him having a grudge against two random women at the YMCA.
Yeah.
And the personal ad aspect is interesting, considering that that personal ad
had been circled
in her room, and not that that particular ad necessarily would have had anything to do with him. I mean, it could have, but between that and her finding her roommates on Craigslist, and, you know, I don't know how she found her two jobs, but there's a good chance that she used classifieds to find her jobs as well.
Yeah.
It definitely fits. Like, it fits that she could have seen an ad that he had placed, or he could have seen an ad that she placed, like, however, and they could have interacted in that way.
Do we know, was John's girlfriend involved in any of this?
Okay, well, yes, let's get to John's girlfriend.
Okay, and is John's girlfriend blonde?
Yeah, so John Anuna and Jill Lampo, who is not blonde, so is not the blonde
not
lady
the blonde
from the mall,
yeah.
More than likely. I mean, I guess she could have worn a wig or, you know, whatever,
sure.
But they eventually broke up. But then in June 2012, right around the 15-year anniversary of Kristen's disappearance, Jill apparently had some sort of breakdown. She called her uncle and had a four-hour phone conversation with him. At some point during it, he decided to start taking notes. And what Jill revealed was alarming. Now, the uncle initially didn't want to get involved in anything. Like, you know, he was just trying to, he took the notes, but he was just like, I'm going to mind my business about this. But his wife was like, oh, no, we don't mind business around here. She read his notes and was like, this is insane. Did some Googling, found the Find Kristen website and Dennis Mann, and sent him a copy of the notes. One section, which Dennis has published on the website, reads, quote, she got involved with a controlling man who convinced her to assist in an unspeakable kidnap and murder, end quote. Over the years, John Anuna has insisted that he never met Kristen and that he just made that phone call to the news station to get back at the two women he didn't like. He said, you know, he said something like, oh, I screwed up. I took the focus off of what the investigation should have been focusing on and put it on me. It was a mistake. But in 2017, to mark the 20-year anniversary of Kristen's disappearance, San Francisco's ABC affiliate tracked Jill down and got her to speak with them. In that interview, it was weird because she agreed to speak on camera as long as they didn't show her face.
But they used her name.
And her voice and like showed her arm, you know?
Yeah, like what's the point of that?
I have no idea. So it was weird because they showed her from like the neck down.
Okay.
And in the interview, she claimed that on June 23rd, 1997, she was at the library. And during the interview, she repeatedly showed the reporter her library card.
I mean, that doesn't prove that you were at the library. It proves that you have a library card.
Yeah, 20 years later. Like,
yeah.
It was bizarre. It was a very short interview, but it was weird. So the reporter obviously asked her about the phone call that John made. And about that, Jill said, quote, to me, that would imply guilt. If you're going to call and draw attention to yourself, that implies you want attention for some reason, end quote.
Okay. I mean, she's not wrong, but what does she know?
I don't know. According to the notes that the uncle took, a lot.
Yeah.
But who knows? And so whether she or John or both have any involvement in what happened to Kristen that day remains unknown. that interview was years ago.
Right.
And no arrests have been made. And now, as we're recording this in 2025, we don't even 100% know that she was the victim of foul play. After all, the bloodhound trail from the Galleria to the 38 Geary line and then to Sutro Heights suggests that Kristen may have headed toward the coast after work, intending to walk or photograph at Land's End. From there, a fall could account for her sudden disappearance. Investigators say that she could have gotten swept downstream and ended up in an underwater cave. However, others say that the area where she would have gone in was heavily trafficked and somebody would have seen something. But one thing that everyone agrees on now is that Kristen didn't run away.
Oh, I didn't think that that was even a theory.
I mean, in the very beginning it was.
Oh.
Like it always is.
Yeah.
But she was living her dream summer, and it became clear early on that something or someone violently ended it. Over the years, Kristen's family has navigated tips from psychics, false sightings, and people claiming to know the truth, who ultimately had nothing to offer. Each one has been a painful reminder of the cruelty of false hope.
There's all of this evidence pointing towards John,
yeah,
being the one that did it. But we don't know, like, did the police, I mean, they obviously interviewed him at least initially.
Mm-hmm.
It sounded like they went back and talked to him again, or maybe multiple times.
Yeah, I don't know how often, like, police spoke with him or how many times, you know. He lives in Honolulu, Hawaii now. He left California several years ago. But Jill apparently still is in the area, or at least did when she was interviewed by ABC.
But we just, it doesn't seem like they did anything else other than interview him and just took his word for it. Like, No, I didn't.
Well, no, they searched his house. They searched Jill's house. And, you know, when they searched his house, like, they didn't find anything related to Kristen. When they searched Jill's house, they found the day planner with the name of the guy who might be connected,
loose.
Yeah. It's certainly loose.
But, I mean, what about all of these allegations from these other women? Where did that go?
I have no idea. It doesn't seem as though John, like, ever went to jail for any of that, ever faced any consequences. And on that episode of America's Most Wanted, which again aired in 1999, so, you know, roughly 2 years after the disappearance, there were three or four women who came forward with different but similar stories about him.
Right. So 2 years after she goes missing. So pretty close.
Yeah. And again, timeline wise, we know that the one that we played on here was after Kristen. I don't know when the other incidents happened. If they were before, I think they were before, you know, like, I think this happened over a number of years.
Right.
But again, that shows a pattern. Like, this man was a predator, and it doesn't seem as though he faced any consequences for any of it.
So, I mean, it almost seems like the police just were like, oh, well, it's a he said, she said.
Yeah.
Leave it alone.
Yeah. That's exactly what it sounds like. And, you know, what's frustrating for a lot of people, including Dennis Mann, the private investigator who runs findkristen.com, is that when he made that insane false report, which, again, even if he had something to do with Kristen's disappearance, like, the report itself was false.
Yeah, which is illegal.
Exactly.
He could have had jail time for that.
Yes. He wasn't arrested for that. Like, he didn't face any consequences for that whatsoever. Other than, you know, searching his house and, you know, obviously being put on the radar and having his name out there. Like, he faced social consequences.
Yeah, but nothing real.
Not legal consequences. Right. And that's extremely frustrating. And I don't know what the reasoning was behind that. And, you know, nobody really does. And so, yeah, this man who, whether he had anything to do with Kristen's disappearance or not, is seemingly not a good guy and has committed multiple crimes.
Allegedly. And yes, of course, you need proof to.
Allegedly. But I mean, the false report is pretty fucking not allegedly.
He admitted that. So he definitely should have faced consequences for that. But, you know,
the one woman on America's Most Wanted showed the scar on her wrist from where she said he burned her with cigarettes. And again, that still makes it, it's still a legend.
Right.
But still, it's like, it's just wild.
There's too much pointing at him,
yeah,
at him for the police to just not push further, not
yeah,
dig a little bit deeper, not pay more attention to him at least.
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy to me. But it also raises a lot more questions, because if John and or Jill were involved in Kristen's death, then what was it that the dogs alerted on at the house? Because it doesn't seem likely that if they were involved, that anything would have happened at Kristen's house in Oakland. I mean, it's not outside of the realm of possibility completely.
Sure.
But it.
Why would they take her back to her house
with a ton of roommates? Yeah. Like, none of that makes any sense.
Right.
So if that was the case, then what on earth was the dog alerting on? Like, you know, what were all those test results? What did that DNA come from? But if all of that is real and something did happen to Kristen in the house or around the house, you know, whatever the case may be, then John and Jill are seemingly a red herring.
Right.
Then is it the four roommates, or, you know, one or more of the four roommates who are involved?
Or somebody from the halfway house.
Yeah. Or is it somebody from the halfway house? Like, there's just so many
possibilities. Yeah. Yeah.
And then again, you had the bloodhound that led to the beach. So maybe nothing happened with John and Jill. Maybe nothing happened at the house. Maybe something happened at the beach. Maybe something happened with somebody at the beach, or maybe it was just an insane, tragic accident.
Yeah, but there's too much pointing towards John and Jill.
Yeah.
And obviously not all of this was known at the time.
Right.
You know, the notes from her uncle were many years later.
Yeah, 15. But years.
Like, okay, well, now all of this is, it's pointing more and more towards John and Jill having some involvement in this.
Yeah. And just from the brief, like, 45-second interview that I saw, she seemed squirrely. And she seemed to me, and again, I'm a layperson, I know nothing, but to me, I got the impression that if she were, like, really pressed by a skilled interrogator in a windowless room, that, like, maybe she would have some things to say. And I just don't know that she's ever been asked.
Yeah. And maybe part of this is that we don't have any of the information as far as what Oakland PD did.
For sure.
Or didn't do, who they talked to, who they didn't talk to, whatever. But it just seems bizarre to me that more attention wasn't focused on John.
Yeah.
Even at the beginning.
Right. Even at the beginning. Exactly. And Mahaney has said, like, over the years, has consistently said that he thinks that this guy knows something. That call that he made and the information that he gave, that specific information that he gave about the wooden bridge and the location and everything, he just has a gut feeling that that didn't just come out of nowhere. That the two women at the YMCA had nothing to do with anything, but that the information he gave had a basis in truth. And that's why he thinks that that's where her body is or was, you know? And again, there's just no physical evidence to support or disprove that theory. And of course, he's long retired, you know, he's moved on.
Sure.
But it's clearly one of those cases that has stuck with him for the past nearly 30 years at this point. As the years and then decades began to pass, the Modafferi family continued to pick up the pieces and live their lives. Her sisters grew up and had families of their own, and in 2014, Bob and Debbie retired to Florida. But tragically, in 2020, Bob was diagnosed with an aggressive form of leukemia, and he passed away in 2022. Debbie later told SFGate.com, quote, "When Bob passed away and I was saying goodbye to him, I told him to please give hugs from all of us to Kristen. Please give Kristen hugs from all of us. I'm praying they're together," end quote. Though Bob died before finding out what happened to his beautiful, brilliant daughter on that summer day in 1997, There are still people who loved her, who remember her, and who are still fighting for answers. And they won't give up until they get them. Kristen Modafferi has been missing from Oakland, California since June 23, 1997. She is a white female with brown hair and brown eyes. At the time of her disappearance, she was approximately 5'8" and 140 pounds. She was last seen wearing a black Spinelli's t-shirt, a long-sleeved dark blue plaid flannel shirt, tan pants, and possibly fly London sneakers with laces in the front and behind the heel. She was carrying a green JanSport backpack. Kristen was 18 when she went missing. She would be 46 today. If you have any information about the disappearance of Kristen Modafferi, please contact the Oakland Police Department Missing Persons Unit at 510-238-3641. You can see all the sources for this episode, along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram and TikTok. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by me, Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketsa. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. At ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.